Good afternoon, everybody. Time is 2:36, Thursday, February 25th, 2010. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, Senator Thomas, and Senator Egan. We have Senator Pascban with us, Senator Stevens, we have Senator French, and we may have, and we have Senator Coghill. We may have other elected officials come and go during the meeting depending on their schedule. This afternoon, we're going to hear from the Department of Law and Legislative Legal Services regarding the May 1st open season date. And specifically, I'd like to address the flexibility we have to make changes in ACES or a G after May 1st and the implications thereof. You know, and we're trying to drill down to our risk exposure. What we're going to do is go ahead and ask Mr. Don Bullock to come forward first, I think, introduce himself for the record, who he represents, and he has a legal opinion, and we'll have some questions, some dialogue. I'm also going to give the visiting senators, if they want to come up and ask a particular question of Mr. Bullock, the opportunity. And we'll, after we take care of the members of the committee, then we'll start that process. Mr. Bullock, tell us what this document says.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Donald Bullock. I'm one of your attorneys in Legislative Legal Services, and I'm here at the request of the committee today. And I believe you're interested in the memo that I wrote that's dated.
Would you please pull your mic forward so we can hear you? And just okay. For those at home, Mr. Bullock has worked several years for the state. He spent a lot of time over the particular oil issues, working alleged legal, involved in these issues. Isn't that not correct?
Yes, that's correct. I was both ACES, PPT, and AGEA were all initiated by the governor. However, once the governor's bills come over to the legislature, then we do the drafting after that point, and I was involved in those pieces of legislation. And a little bit more of my tax background. I was with the Department of Revenue for 17 years, including 13 years as a hearing officer. Okay. The question that's addressed in the memo is whether the state is bound by the tax exemption in AS 4390-320. And if you're familiar with AGEA, under AS 4390-300, producers that make a firm transportation commitment during the open season enjoy the benefit of the two resource inducements. The first one is in 4390-310, which has to do with royalty. And this memo addresses the second one, which is in 4390-320, that provides a tax exemption that is to counter any increase in tax after the tax that's in effect on the first date or the first day the open season starts. And the question was, how much flexibility is in there? And this relates to our discussions earlier, the last couple of years, about the contracting away or limiting taxes by contract, or this one took the exemption approach, which in my opinion was most consistent with Article 9, Section 4, which allows for exemptions to be created by general law. As a law, it is just like every other law that you consider in the legislature. You can amend it, you can repeal it, you can change it. If you do, the memo addresses some of the possible repercussions. And to back up a minute, if you look at the agreement that the state has with TransCanada, which is the licensee for the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act project, there are certain agreements. When the request for proposals went out, it was clear as to what the state expected. There's a number of commitments that were expected. And then the legislature gave them the license, and it amounts to a contract. And when reviewed whether they should be awarded the license, we talked about not changing the terms and conditions that were in the law, because that would have made it a different proposal and would have changed the terms. But this issue as to the inducements that are offered to the producers is different than the relationship with the licensee. But it's related to that, to the extent that these inducements actually encourage a producer to make that binding commitment during the first binding open season. So if it's favorable, it would encourage them to make the commitment earlier rather than later, because after the first open season, if there are not any binding commitments, all these inducements that are based on the first open season go away, and all the producers are equal if there's a subsequent open season. So if this inducement was amended, 4390.320 was amended to make it less attractive, and there are insufficient numbers of producers that commit during the first binding open season, there may be an issue from the licensee, TransCanada, side as to whether the state has done something to impair what they expected would happen, which was the state has encouraged people to make the commitment so the project can go forward after the first open season. But if the attractiveness of the inducement is taken away, then TransCanada might argue that the state impeded their project by taking away inducements, and therefore it resulted in fewer people or no commitments at all. They'd have to wend their way through on a crooked path to get there, but that's the possibility. I believe that pretty much summarizes what I explained in the memo. Basically, it's a law. You can change it, you can amend it, repeal it, whatever, depending on whether you increase or decrease the value of the inducement may have an effect down the road.
So could you kind of highlight the issue of May 1st, the current May 1st coming up, in the, which is the what we commonly refer to here as the start of the first binding open season, and the significance of
right.
that?
TransCanada has told the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that their open season is going to start on May 1st. And the qualification for resource inducements is in the statutes at AS 4390.300. And that requires the first binding, the first commitments to qualify for the inducements. And in 4390.320, it sets up, would it be helpful if I read it, or?
However you want to deliver it. We got time, so
All right.
Paying attention.
If a person is qualified for a resource inducement under AS 4390.300 agrees under C of this section, the person is entitled to an annual exemption from the state's gas production tax in an amount equal to the difference between the amount of the person's gas production tax obligation calculated under the gas production tax in effect during that tax year. So this is a future year within the 10-year period that's described in AS 4390.320, and that's the 10-year period in which they enjoy the exemption. So you look at future production, you look at what the tax law is at that point, and that's the first number you calculate. And what you compare that to is the amount of the person's gas production tax in effect at the start of the first binding open season held under this chapter, which is the with regard to the license project. And it's the start of the first binding open season that presents you with the May 1st date. That's when that season starts. So that it's clear as of that date that somebody that's considering making a commitment into the pipeline project can read this, figure out what their tax obligation is under current law, as the law exists on that date, and decide whether that should be a factor as to whether they commit during the first open season.
So if we, on May 2nd, someday after May 1st, we decide to make a structural change within our tax environment, do we have potentially some exposure with TransCanada or licensee? Or?
You know, there's nothing to prevent that. There's nothing to prevent from any amendment in the law or to this, but what follows would be the repercussions. And what the expectation would be, because this may be considered by a producer to change the circumstances, at least as of May 1st, as to whether they make a commitment or not. It definitely would muddy the waters, and depending on the interests, it's hard to say what would happen. But I would concentrate on May 1st to avoid the issues that would be created after that.
Concentrate on the dates before May 1st.
Right. Try and get the tax law in place that you expect to be the base tax rate for this open season.
Okay. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the first sentence in A of 439328, if a person qualified, could you describe a person qualified, and then how the connection is made between this and the oil tax that is causing the concern? When is a person qualified?
The qualification of a person to qualify for the inducements determined under AS 439300. And the real issue is whether they've made a firm commitment during the open season.
That's right.
If they don't, it's not clear whether a conditional commitment is a firm commitment. Good argument could be that it's not, because the law says that it has to be a firm commitment made during the first open season. And if there's a conditional commitment that doesn't occur and the condition's not met until later, then the plain words of the statute, they failed to make a firm commitment. Once they do qualify for the inducement, it's a tax inducement and it's only on gas. So the Department of Revenue would no doubt be challenged with a project of determining in the combined approach that ACES takes, in which gas and oil are combined for tax purposes, they're going to have to separate the tax that's on gas for this base period and then compare that to a future tax on gas. So it's not as easy as it was before PPT, when gas and oil were both taxed separately.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? We will have, I know Senator Baskin has asked to ask a couple questions, if you can come forward, and probably just, there's an extra chair at the end of the table. For those, I don't know if Senator French was in here when we first started, but we'll...
He's still there.
Yeah, we're going to... And Senator Coghill and Senator Stevens, if they... And Senator Pascal's done, if they have a question they want to ask, they can just flag me and I'll bring them up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You can identify for the record who you are and who you represent. And
sure. My name is Joe Paskvan, Senator for Fairbanks and Fort Wainwright in Interior, Alaska. Okay. And if I understand, Mr. Bullock, good afternoon, the indication that I heard from you is that it would be better...
Maybe before we start heading down that road, maybe what we'll do is we'll run all the questions through the chairman. That's keep the flow going. And
thank
and
you.
Then, I think what I'll do, rather than have me try to repeat the question to Mr. Bullock, we'll just have him answer it, and then if he has trouble deciphering what the question was, he can signal me and I'll have you re-ask it or whatever. But it's not a, you know, this isn't a courtroom, you got two lawyers, but so you guys got to explain it so I can understand it in finance terms instead of legal terms.
All right.
So would you prefer that I ask the question through the chair then?
Yes.
Thank you.
And then and maybe pull the microphone up if you could.
Sure. Is that better?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Through the chair, under AS 439320, does it have an intended statutory effect based upon a reading of the clear language of that statute?
Through the chair, as I understand it, what this statute is intended to do, as I said earlier, is look at the future production of gas, apply the tax in effect on that gas to come up with a tax liability, and then compare that tax liability with the amount on that same future production as if the law that's in effect now would be applicable to that. So it's the amount due under the new tax in a future period compared to the amount of that production on the future period, but applying current law. So the exemption is there if there's a tax increase on gas, basically, is the way it works, and the amount of the exemption is equal to the difference.
Yes, through the chair, there was a presentation by the Commissioner of Revenue using figures that are consistent with forecasted prices during the years 2020 through 2030 as to pricing, and that indicated a loss of revenues under current law at $2 billion a year. Is that the intended statutory effect of that language that you see?
I am not part of the policy as that was behind this provision. So I'm not sure exactly what was intended or what was anticipated at the time that this section was put in. I should note that this section, as it was enacted, was in the governor's original bill as it was introduced, and it was not modified as it went through. So the administration, many of whom are still here, may be in a better position to answer that question.
Through the chair, you are not saying that the $2 billion per loss potentially for a decade is inaccurate?
I can't say whether it's accurate or not. Mr. Chair, there's one other thing that I should point out because it's related to the gas issue, and that has to do with the tax rates in AS 4355011. Would you like to speak to that, or do you want to?
No, you can speak to it. Go ahead.
As you recall, under 4355011G, there are two different tax rates that are applied to the production tax value of the oil and gas. The first is the 25%. The second is the rate that's determined by looking at the average barrel of oil equivalent value compared to $30. So if the barrel of oil equivalent value is above 30, then you multiply the difference between that number and 30 and you get the tax rate. Because of the differential value in gas, it's 6 million cubic feet of gas has the energy equivalent of, or 6 million BTUs has the energy equivalent of one barrel of oil. So you have relatively higher priced oil compared to gas. And as the gas mixed into that, the average value is going to decrease because it's maybe inappropriate, but I was using the single malt blended whiskey approach, that the single malt has a higher value, but you mix the cheaper stuff in and it brings the price of it down. And that's the effect that the lower gas prices would have on that average price. So it would have a tax effect in there as well as any anything related to the exemption in the AGIA exemption.
Okay. Do you have a, go ahead, Senator Pascal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I would like to address now is the ability of a person to make statements and bind an entity. And the question that I have, do statements of the Commissioner of Revenue have a legal effect when making official statements in matters dealing with revenue issues?
Through the chair, there are cases that say that when the department speaks, that if it's inconsistent in the statute, that the statute rules. So that everybody can look at the law without knowing what the commissioner may have said on a particular point, and it would be the statutes and the regulations that would apply if they were in conflict.
Have you,
through
the chair, have you received any information that any statement from the Commissioner of Revenue is inconsistent with the reading of the statute, the language of the statute?
Through the chair, I have not, but I'm not aware of all the statements, and because of my workload, I haven't been able to listen to all the hearings that you've been conducting here in Senate Finance.
Are admissions that are made by a person that can speak on behalf of an entity, such as a Commissioner of Revenue would make on behalf of the state of Alaska, of greater evidentiary value than opinions?
repeating what I said earlier, if what he says is in conflict with written law, the written law would apply. But there's an exception. When things go into court, it's an issue of what language means. And first of all, there has to be at least an ambiguity before the court looks forward, you know, beyond that. But the court is open to looking at legislative intent and can consider comments like that. This was an administration bill, so that legislative intent may be influenced by what the administration testified to at the time. If it comes down to the point where the agency has actually adopted regulations or official regarding an interpretation to be made, the court will sometimes defer to agency expertise in interpreting what the provisions may. And that's different than the court usually, its first option, if it's a matter of statutory interpretation, like contract interpretation, the court will independently review it. But again, if it's a matter of agency expertise, the court may defer to the agency's interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Commissioner Galvin has stated that he believes that May 1, 2010 is a lock-in date. Do you have a better lock-in date than the commissioners under your reading of the AGIA statutes?
Under the words of AS 4393-20, it's the tax in effect at the start of the first mining open season held under this chapter. May 1st could change if the beginning of the open season changes.
Through the chair, Commissioner Galvin has also stated that lawmakers have until May 1, 2010 to make changes. And I understand, based upon your initial presentation, that you agree that between now and May 1, 2010 is the time that that lawmakers have to make changes, if that is appropriate.
Through the chair, yes, but also take into consideration the governor will have to sign it into law so that it is a law that's in effect on that date.
Through the chair, Commissioner Galvin has stated that the legislature has this legislative session to make sure that the state of Alaska is comfortable with being locked in. Do you believe that the comfort that we have to have is that after May 1, 2010, that the state of Alaska may in fact suffer repercussions or the consequences that are negative to the state of Alaska if changes were made after May 1, 2010?
Through the chair, I don't have the factual information to answer that question. The issues that I identified earlier that may occur if there's changes after that date would apply, depending on where the interests are between TransCanada and the producers.
Mr. Chair, on a general basis, would you state that changes, if they are to be made, should be made before May 1, 2010?
In my opinion, that if they were to be made before May 1st, that would avoid all the issues that would arise if they were made after that date.
And there are potential, through the chair, there are potential serious legal and constitutional questions that might be asserted if the change were made after May 1, 2010.
I can only speculate to that, but that is a possibility.
Through the chair, those potential constitutional effects in part are raised in your memorandum. It's called an ex post facto law, that a change in the law after a binding commitment has been made is a prohibited state action.
The chair, in earlier discussions as to whether we could put a limitation like this in by contract rather than by law, it was recognized in the legislative history that the law reserves the legislature's flexibility in amending laws as it sees fit. This is not binding except morally. I mean, every legislature after this can look at this law and continue to decide whether it's in the state's best interest to deal with this. It's not dissimilar to even the leasing that our own agency, Legislative Affairs, enters into, where in that provision it says that appropriations for the lease are subject to every every legislature's determination that it's in the state's best interest. Similarly, this is a statutory, it's not a contractual inducement. As any law, a taxpayer can expect that under circumstances that may be amended or changed.
Through the chair, what legal theories come to your mind if you were representing TransCanada Exxon that it might assert based upon the state's failure to honor a May 1, 2010 lock-in?
Through the chair, I think if I was in the situation of TransCanada and Exxon, the first thing, obviously, is look at the end of the open season. What happens after that? Who's shown up? If they have the firm transportation commitments, they could say that this inducement didn't make a difference. If they can develop a case that reducing the value of the inducement had a direct effect on those that would show up and make a commitment during the firm open season, they may argue that they were harmed or that it impaired TransCanada's expectations under the license. But I think it would be difficult to prove because this is a legislative discretion as to what the statutes are and what the state's best interests are required. So the issue's there, but I don't know whether they would be successful in bringing that sort of suit.
Through the chair, Mr. Bullock, as far as the state's ability to deal with a potential $2 billion per year for a decade loss to the revenue stream of this state, if I understand what you're saying, is you assert that that should occur between now and May 1, 2010.
Through the chair, my only suggestion on May 1st is that changes after that date, because it's after the first open season, and which is in progress. If the changes are made after that, it raises issues that don't arise if the changes are made before that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Senator Pascal. We have no other hands up. So just to kind of put it in layman's terms, if we take action before May 1st, our risk exposure is
reduced.
If there is a risk, let me rephrase that. If there's a risk exposure to the state changing it after May 1st, we could avoid that by taking action. And the legislature, we all recognize it's a statute issue and the governor has to sign the bill. But we'd have to have that done by May 1st.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the key words are the production tax in effect at the first binding open season,
right?
At the start of the first binding open season.
Right. Okay, we have any other questions for Mr. Bullock? Okay, thank you.
Senator
Pascal, Mr. Bullock, you might as well just stay there. You look pretty comfortable in the chair. And I don't know if the next set of questions later on with the Department of Law, or if you're more comfortable, you could step back. But it's kind of up to you, Ms. Pollard, if she can come forward and. You could maybe help us with a few issues. Introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and we're just.
Is that good on sound?
Yep. Yeah, or just pull it right in and.
Right. My name is Susan Pollard. I'm an attorney with Assistant Attorney General with Oil, Gas, and Mining here in Juneau, and I did not prepare a memorandum as did Mr. Bullock, because I wasn't exactly sure where we wanted to go on questioning. I can add a little bit to a couple issues that were brought up. One question was about the requirements for qualification.
Could you please pull your microphone in?
Yes.
Thank you.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, I am prepared to address the couple questions that were sort of sent to me from Revenue that apparently the committee wanted to address, but I thought it would make sense to hear from you first. How you wanted to approach it.
Go ahead and answer the questions you have.
All right, the couple questions that I was specifically asked to look at was the possibility, which is the one you just ended on, which was the possibility that the state would face some liabilities, were some of the AGIA provisions, such as 4390, 320, to be repealed or amended, either before or after May 1st and whatever date, particularly since a license has been issued and some contractual commitments have been made. And I guess the planets are in a line, because I do agree with most of what Mr. Bullock says, that in general, when this legislation was discussed, it was made clear that although there was an attempt to make it a contractual benefit, that was not what was eventually enacted. And it was clear that the legislature could change legislation in the future on that, just under its general authorities to always be able, particularly in the tax area, to change law. As perhaps a practical or general matter, some might argue that AGIA applicants were on notice, because this was discussed in the session of 2007, the possibilities of how the exemption would work. Specific issues on litigation, you know, Department of Law is really not prepared to address in a public setting, which is sort of where we ended, like what would the possible arguments be on each side or another, that would be something that we wouldn't really do in a public setting. One thing that we discussed a little bit this morning in our section was thinking ahead that in terms of vested interests, who's got interests under this sort of AGIA setup, it's good to remember that in terms of shippers, perhaps their interests are really not going to be vested until way down the road when they sign a transportation services agreement that would have more details about the amount of gas shipped and what their actual bit of the gas line is. So to that sense, to say that someone would have a real vested interest right now, I think is undercut a little bit. Did you have any questions on that aspect? I will, if I could, go back to a little bit of a question, which was about who actually gets the inducement under 4390-300, which is the general inducement section, that both the Commissioner of Revenue and the Commissioner of Natural Resources have to agree that a person qualifies. And, you know, we think of it as a certificate. They get this blessing that they would qualify to either get a royalty inducement or a gas inducement. And that is something that is handled in proposed regulations by both the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Revenue, and it sets out those steps. That does a statutory interpretation as to what committed to acquire means, and that it's not so much just handing in a bid. You also have to go, or the person who makes the bid also has to go through some steps. As I said, these are proposed regulations, the type of steps that would implement 4390-300. They are proposed both by Department of Natural Resources in the regulations they just noticed, and by the Department of Revenue, and those will be vetted through the process. So there's only so much you can really say about a proposed regulation, because the agencies may make adjustments based on the kind of public comment they get. The second and perhaps more direct question that it was my understanding the committee wanted a little information on was somewhat specific to the revenue's proposed regulation on what gas production tax means, but it's really a more general question that was addressed in just the earlier testimony by Mr. Bullock, which is what does 4390-320, this gas tax obligation calculated under the gas production tax in the time at the start of open season, mean? And if I have this correct, that's what the committee has some concerns about. What are you locked into at that particular provision, at that particular moment in time? And that there are concerns that you would not be able to change your lock-in provision as to what the production tax obligation is. To look at this issue, it seems like you have to go back just one step and just look at general statutory authority and what agencies need to do to implement a statute and to have it make sense. And as Mr. Bullock pointed out, there are a couple issues in 4390-320 that require agency interpretation and regulation. It talks about the person's gas production tax obligated, calculated under the gas production tax in effect at the time. Currently, like, let's just keep May 1st as the open season date. We have 4355 is your production tax, which tends to calculate values for oil and gas, sometimes together and sometimes apart, like gas used in state is handled under a separate section. So all the regulation does is implement, or all the Department of Revenue's current way of clarifying this statutory provision is to define the gas production tax and what that means under your current setup. It doesn't have anything to do with the current tax obligations of anybody right now. And what you would be locking in is sort of a formula for taking your current 4355 and sort of parsing out your gas, which is why the regulation goes through a few steps. And all it does is set out that gas that is going to be committed during open season, which is going to be a volume, and I guess a term of years, and it's going to be the gas that ships through the North Slope. So it's only going to apply to a very small element of gas. It's well within, for certainly, agency discretion to do something like that. Obviously, all regulations have to be in comport with statutory authority, and both they get reviewed by the Department of Law. All proposed regulations also go through legislative affairs, and in general, regulations, as long as they're consistent with the statutory authority, are upheld as reasonable. The current setup, or what you would have on May 1st, if you didn't have any regulatory scheme in effect to sort of parse out or to explain what this gas production tax is it would be probably a little bit unclear about what a producer would use in the future to run their numbers through and find out what their gas production tax is. And all this attempts to do is to give everybody notice that here's how the state is going to do a baseline calculation for your comparison to figure out whether you would have a tax exemption or not, which would be basically, is your tax going to be lower under the current setup as it would be in the future setup? I think there's been some concern that some of the relationship between oil and gas, what some people call the parity issue, some people call it subsidization, the ratio, it would necessarily carry forward, and it would restrict your ability in the future to make changes to the oil and gas production tax, perhaps to separate them or something. And that's also that's what the Department of Law has been looking at a little bit this week. And it's the department's position that the current approach, regardless of whether this particular regulation is even adopted or not, even a proposed regulation can go through some changes, that there's no obligation that would apply to a future calculation, regardless of what the tax looks like in the future, tax two, whatever you want to call it, that would apply to how you calculate those numbers to do the comparison with the baseline tax. And I hope that answered one of the questions that seemed to be floating out.
Let's try to. I've had trouble hearing testimony, to be quite honest.
A little bit closer.
The fundamental issue that concerns some of us at the committee is the May 1st deadline and the alterations of the tax structure before it, which seems to be clear we can do what we want to up to May 1. After May 1 and after, do we have any risk exposure to TransCanada if we make that change and they have some difficulty in securing enough commitments to go forward with their project in the first binding open season. And it seems to be fairly clear we can change the statute anytime we want to. It's a statute, but it's the ramifications of the change that we're concerned about. And the probability, I guess, of that exposure and the amount of dollars we're talking about.
I guess I'm not sure what your question is. I mean, I understand that there's concerns about trying to change the statute after May 1st and what that exposure would be, but I'm not sure what you're talking about changing and how that would affect the licensee.
If we were to decide to make a change, for instance, if we were to separate oil and gas, as an example, or any other change in our tax structure, if we did it before May 1st or after May 1st, it seems to be fairly clear from Mr. Bullock's presentation, if we do it before May 1st, it's clearly before the date of the first open season, beginning date of the first open season, so it's a non-issue. If it's done afterwards, I think Mr. Bullock said that there may be some exposure to TransCanada if they feel they have some alteration in their process that wasn't favorable to them going forward due to the changes that we made. And that's in layman's terms.
Trust Edman, to answer your question, let's take the example you used, that you separate the tax out and all of a sudden you have a PPT-like thing. You have gas and oil and you do it on May 15th. Can we just use that as an example? But you leave 439320 as it is. So then what you have is a gas production tax at the start of open season, which would be what we have on the books today. And you have a gas production tax, what we have on the books today is the oil and gas production tax with some regulatory action by the department to define what gas production tax is for the purpose of the AGIA exemption. And then you have your May 15th tax that's a separate oil and gas tax. So now the exemption comparison is between what you have on the books May 1st and your tax as of May 15th, your gas tax, to compare the two. So I'm not seeing exactly where the risk is based on that example with your question. If your question is a complete change to the exemption provision, then I think you're right.
Let me try to restate it and be clear. And again, it's probably even making it more difficult than it should be, being a non-attorney trying to give a technical answer to a non-technical question. If we change the tax after May 1st, sometime before, gas is flowing, And we've had some analysis run that shows we could have an exposure up to, or a change in cash flow to the state of up to $2 billion, depending on the parity issues, relationships between gas and oil. So there's a significant amount of cash difference on the table. Is our risk exposure by that change increased by making a change of that tax after May 1 or before May 1?
Through the chair.
Is there no exposure at all? We can change anytime we want to, and there's no recourse from TransCanada or anybody else.
Okay, so under your question, the change would then be to 320, that it would be the gas production tax no longer in effect at the start of open season, but at a different date.
Could you, I didn't understand what you said.
If
Mr. Bullock, you look like you're anxious to.
Let me explain a little bit. My memo addresses kind of the basis for the risk. Basically, the state has a contract with TransCanada to carry this project forward. And another provision of AGIA, we have this competing gas line issue, that the state's not going to go out and encourage a competing gas line, provide inducements. That exposes the state to statutory risks. This, it's similar in that, okay, the contract, TransCanada, go forward, do what you have to do, design the project, go to open season, let's get some commitments, let's get the thing going. And in return, TransCanada is going to get some money from us to help reimburse them for some of the costs. Now, if the state changes the inducements after May 1st, after the season started, the issue is based on whether the state has impaired the contract between the state and TransCanada. I think it would be a difficult lawsuit for them, but I'm not saying that it couldn't happen. That their argument was because the inducement, the value had been decreased, that it was this, there was less of an incentive for shippers to come forward and make the commitments. I mean, that's, it's really, it's the impairment of contract issue where the risk lies, because there's a specific prohibition against passing legislation that impairs the obligations of contracts.
Yes, Ms. Poland, is that?
With that clarification, then, if your question is they would change the exemption, yes, I agree with, you know, that that there's always some risk, but, you know, once again, going back to what I said at the beginning, that I think everybody was aware that certainly that issue was vetted when the AGIA tax went through.
Can you repeat that, please?
I'm sorry?
Your last sentence?
That issue was considered, which was how the AGIA and the tax exemptions would, if in any way, affect the legislature's ability to change future statutes.
Do we have any other questions for Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe we had long discussions about whether future legislatures could be bound, and people believe not. I think this is a more narrow question of the idea of people relying on language that exists and the date of when it is in existence or not. So I'm sure it would be an issue even if it were changed before May 1st, but it's more likely a public relations issue than it is a legal issue. But the idea of changing it prior to and avoiding legal issues is where we're trying to get to, or at least where I'm trying to get to, and understand that if in fact we decouple, and that would be at least my assessment, what we would be looking for to do to simplify the process of oil and gas taxation not being tied together, because there's been a lot of discussion about the difficulty with regulations as they exist anyhow. So if we were to decouple oil and gas taxes before the open season, do you believe that we would open the state up to legal action by TransCanada and Exxon for basically reducing the value of the exclusive license that TransCanada has?
If you were to, let me make sure I understand your question through the chair. If you were to change the tax so that it would be a separate tax on gas and a tax on oil, and would you make any changes to 4390-320?
Pardon me, I'm having a little trouble understanding you here.
Would you make any changes to the general gas production tax exemption statute that says, here's how you do your gas?
I would assume we would, yes. Or I can have you assume that we would.
Okay.
But you're right. We would separate the two. We would make changes. And would that give TransCanada and Exxon the opportunity to sue the state based on the idea that we had reduced the value of the exclusive license?
Through the chair, I mean, to answer questions about the license details, I'm really not prepared to answer. That's not an area I've worked on. And once again, there's some discomfort getting into a discussion of potential litigation positions or issues that might come up.
Mr. Bullock, you look like you
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the statute itself says that the start of the open seasoning is when that snapshot's going to be taken, is what the tax is. So, and everybody knows that. And so we're not even deciding. It doesn't say the tax is in effect on February 25th. It says on the first day of the open season, whatever that is. This was enacted 2 years ago. Could have happened. The tax could have been changed at any time. Mr. Chairman, if I could have one other comment, though, sure. That it may be to diffuse any problems. I mean, if you look at these inducements are only applicable to the first open season. If the first open season fails, then you'll be faced with the issue of whether do you continue to need inducements or what was the problem? We'll know a lot more after the first open season. But I think that if there were to be a change after May 1st in which the inducement was devalued a little bit, perhaps there would be other inducements that you could come up with to offset that. I mean, the purpose of all this, and sometimes we get the blinders on, is to get the pipeline moving as early as possible by encouraging those firm commitments as early as possible.
Senator Thomas?
If I may, thank you, Mr. Chairman. But that is exactly the concern. We all hope for a successful open season, although there's a lot of reasons to believe one way or the other there. But that is the concern, that we would then be locked in if that were the case. If it's a successful open season, we haven't changed the tax, there is a much better opportunity for those that are involved in that transaction, that open season transaction, whatever their relationship is, to sue based on now their reduction in their potential profits from whatever they're going forward with as the tax would be changed. Obviously, we may not even have the regulations and everything in place, but obviously there was a change that would be most likely not for their best interests. Okay. All right. Thanks.
Do we have any other questions for our two guests? Yeah, Senator Coghill. Maybe you can come on up and. Well, you could see who. Maybe grab. I don't know who you're going to direct the question to. Maybe grab Ms. Poland's chair.
Or. Get that out of there. There you go.
Mr. Chairman, this would be a question for Mr. Bullock to begin with.
Maybe introduce yourself for the record so we know who you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. I'm Senator Coghill from Senate District F. Thank you. Mr. Bullock, in reading this, it's just for clarification. The C under this section that we're referring to says a person qualified for a resource inducement under this 499300. Agrees under C, and it seems to me like when we put this inducement together, it was for the exclusive licensee to offer to producers, because it seemed to me like that's how it worked. And so is that what we're saying under C?
Through the chair, you're talking about which C?
Oh. Yeah, the second line where we're under 4390-320A. And it references agrees under sub C. So I just wanted to make sure that I understood that correctly. I didn't have the statute book in front of me, so I want to make sure I understand that before I get to the next question. Thank you.
Yeah, subsection C refers to the person claiming the exemption, in other words, the person that's made the firm commitment, agreeing that the person and the person's affiliates will not protest or appeal a filing by the licensee to roll in mainline expansion costs up to the level that the licensee is required to propose and support. If you recall, this is the rolled-in rate issue that is to diminish the burden on new production from carrying the full cost of the expansion of the pipeline. And there's a commitment, but it's ultimately it's going to be up to FERC or the RCA if they have jurisdiction to determine the rate. So they're just required to make the argument that they're not going to protest those.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, my question then was going to follow that if there is a condition that had something to do with the rate, would it mess with that particular section?
No, the commitment not to protest the rolled-in rates is a condition of receiving the tax exemption. So they have to agree with that in addition to making the firm transportation commitment during the open season.
Senator Coghill, you have a, looks like you're ready to have another one.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the question that I was struggling with as I was listening to this is the start of a binding open season is what we're talking about here, and but the condition is what they'll agree to before they get there, and I just wanted to make sure I understood that correctly, so that if there was a condition that actually violated this subsection C, I wanted to make sure I understood that, and then if it was the start of an open season, would a binding season be applicable if it was a conditioned open season?
Could you say that again, please?
Mr. Chairman, the operative word here is binding season. We're starting a binding open season.
Correct.
And would a conditioned open season be a binding open season?
Through the chair, I don't believe so. And the reason is that there it has to be a firm commitment during the open season. If there's a condition that can't be met during the open season, then there wasn't a firm commitment during the open season itself. But I should point out that there's different kinds of commitments. There's commitments that has to do with changes that TransCanada might make in their project itself. And there are other commitments that TransCanada, or other conditions that TransCanada has no control over, that may be a condition of a firm commitment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was all I had.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for our guests today? Seeing no questions, that takes care of today's. Just hold it, I'll take it at ease. Got a question to Ms. Pollard. If she could come back up, please.
Try this mic. Oh, Mr. Bullard?
Both of you would be fine if possibly one.
And we got just a one or two more questions, I guess, here, and we'll be done.
Just a few questions.
If you could introduce yourself again for the record.
Yes, Senator Joe Pascvan, Senator from Fairbanks and Fort Wainwright. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, the issue of notice was raised by you, and the question that I have is, under the system as we are operating now, can one assume that TransCanada Exxon, in announcing its open season, has put the state on notice that it, if any changes are to occur, that those changes should occur before May 1, 2010, based upon the notice issue?
Through the chair, it's not so much the notice issue as the statute itself said that whenever the open season starts, that's going to be when the taxes are determined. And in the original GIA terms, the licensee was required to have an open season within a certain time period. And I believe they picked that. They've actually moved it up a little bit within what would have been the outside requirements. So in a way, the date has just become more specific. But there's always been an expected period in which this issue would come up.
Okay.
And through the chair.
Just a follow up and go ahead.
Yes, the last question is, in a contingent open season, do they have until December 5th, 2011 to resolve those contingencies, at which point in time it will have become a binding open season and then locking in as of May 1, 2010.
Mr. Bullock, can you help us with that?
Through the chair, we'd be getting into issues of what the statute means when it says to acquire firm transportation capacity in the first binding open season. There's some conflict in the language that's in our statute and in the regulations that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has, is they just talk about an open season. And their concern is, I mean, what the open season does and what these firm commitments do is it shows there's a need for a pipeline. They get together, they get the commitment saying these are the people that are ready to go. This establishes the need, and it's the basis. So if it's not firm, then arguably there may not be a basis for the public convenience and necessity.
Okay.
No further questions.
That's fine, Chair. Thank you. And the last question, Senator Thomas, and we can wrap her up for the day.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then we'll follow up, well, I guess one last question from Senator Egan, and then we'll wrap it up for the day.
Question would be, if we decoupled, if decoupled oil and gas in the future, and that caused an effective raise of the oil tax while leaving taxes on gas the same as proposed or in existing regulation, do you believe we would have some type of liability under this same section 45 or 43 55 320?
Through the chair, the exemption is based on what's the tax on gas at the start of the open season compared to what's the tax on gas in the future. It's only gas. It's not related to oil. It may have an overall revenue effect, but there's no link between the gas tax under this exemption and the oil tax.
Okay. Thank you. And Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Galvin's in the audience. I'd just like to hear minute or two.
He's had his opportunity here. We're speaking to the Department of Law and our ledge legal. If you have a question for them, you can ask them the question. I'm not going to call Commissioner Galvin to the table.
Okay.
Do you have a question for him?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I had a question for the commissioner.
Okay, that's fine. Okay, that concludes today's hearing. We'll post tomorrow. I don't know if we're going to have anything on the schedule. And next week we have Energy Council. The following week we'll start doing a bunch of bill work and start our capital budget process and close up our operating accounts. Meeting adjourned.